Mexico's long complained that drug gangs terrorize cities with high-powered weapons smuggled from the U.S. Now Mexican lawmakers are up in arms over revelations that the U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, known as the ATF, intentionally allowed thousands of these weapons into the hands of Mexican drug gangs as part of Operation Fast and Furious. The president of Mexico's lower house of Congress said yesterday, "The operation is a grave violation of international rights. What happens if the next time they'll need to funnel in trained assassins, for example, or nuclear arms?" One fellow Mexican congressman claims that an estimated 150 shooting injuries and deaths are linked to the guns that were allowed by U.S. agents to proceed into Mexico. When asked directly about the program, President Obama said in an interview with Univision's Jorge Ramos that neither he nor Attorney General Eric Holder authorized the controversial Operation Fast and Furious and therefore could not inform President Felipe Calderon. Laura Carlson is director of the Americas Program at the Center for International Policy. She's based in Mexico City. Carlson's in Chicago to lecture about the drug war, and she gave us some background on the scandal.
So what actually happens is that the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Bureau decides to watch gun buyers at these gun shops, particularly in the Phoenix area, without interrupting the flow of the guns. And they begin this operation well over a year ago at certain shops. They're watching people come in and buy up to 20 AK-47s or Barrett 50s at a time in these gun shops and walk out with them. They're then watching them exchange these two smugglers in parking lots nearby and presumably take them over the border. They say that the reason for this was that they were tired of catching small fish and they wanted to go further up the chain, that they were going to try to bust not only the leaders and the runners of these smuggling rings, but also the cartels that were buying in Mexico. That never happened. In fact, they now admit that once they got over the Mexican border, they were unable to track most of these weapons. So what you had instead was the sanctioned flow of an estimated 2,500 major weapons going to Mexico directly into the hands of the drug cartels.
Now, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms has been trying to trace things with an e-trace system, and they think that they can really track weapons in a new and different way. Is this related to that at all?
It's all part, Fast and Furious and the e-trace system, of the Project Gunrunner. And Project Gunrunner was important because it was sort of the symbol of reciprocity with Mexico on this drug war issue. The United States was saying, we understand that we have responsibility because of the demand for drugs in our country, and we understand that we have responsibility because of gun running and the flow of arms from north to south that's feeding the violence of the drug cartels here. And in fact, the Mexican government made a major issue when Calderon was here in May of last year. He went to Congress with this issue, calling for a return of the assault ban and other things. So they are all part of the same thing, but the e-trace program that they put a lot of technology and effort and expense into, basically, all it can do is tell you where a gun came from after it's been used to kill somebody in Mexico. It's decommissioned weapons. So you're basically coming into the story after the fact when the damage has been done.
And in this case, with this Operation Fast and Furious, they're watching the things unfold and not stopping them, which I imagine is what the Mexican government would have liked to see happen. That would be what the reciprocity would be all about, is stopping the guns.
Absolutely. There's outrage in Mexico. It's on the front page of the newspapers every week saying United States sanctioned the flow of guns to the drug cartels here in Mexico. The government's been strangely silent about it because they don't want to jeopardize what's an increasingly important relationship with the United States that means a lot to President Felipe Calderon politically, and especially as we come into an electoral period. But the public and the press has been on this case because they feel it's absolutely unjustifiable.
In the United States, we've seen Senator Grassley try to weed out information about this, and he's having a hard time.
Yeah, he's done a praiseworthy job of trying to get to the bottom of this case. Even before the ATF, Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms agents came out as whistleblowers, and told their direct experience about what was going on with the Fast and Furious program. He began by sending letters, according to information he had from insiders, to the Bureau and requiring them to come and brief members of Congress on what exactly was happening there, and they simply refused. He then stepped up the pressure and began to find out that some of the people he was talking to within the agency were being harassed and even threatened with being fired by the ATF officials themselves. And now finally what's happened as a result of the stonewalling by ATF is that Congress is subpoenaing ATF to come and make a presentation on the program there. Eric Holder of the Department of Justice, of course, has also called for an investigation, but his own department has been deeply implicated in the Fast and Furious program.
People expect that someone higher up would have to approve this kind of program, and it should be him in theory.
That's right. They know, in fact, from the statements of the whistleblowers and other people within ATF, that the program was being run by the Department of Justice. So now we're in a situation of kind of a Mexico gate, where the question is who knew what when, and beginning to hope at least that in this investigation it will be ascertained at what level this program was authorized and also why, what exactly was the rationale behind it, and how could they possibly have authorized a program that's in violation of the laws of both Mexico and the United States and also jeopardizes a very, very important binational relationship.
To give them some kind of credit, would you think that it's possible that once the guns crossed the Mexican border, that there was another element, that the guns were going to continue to be watched and there was going to be some kind of surveillance that would lead you to the mythical, gigantic gun buyer in Mexico who is really utilizing the U.S. to get the guns that he needs to fight his drug war?
Yes, it's conceivable. And in fact, there are some versions that say that one of the reasons they adopted this program was because they'd come under fire for previous efforts that had only ended up getting people at a lower level. But there's another problem that they were facing, trying to prosecute within the United States, and that is that it's not illegal to do this. People can walk into a gun shop and buy 20 AK-47s, and there's nothing in the laws that say that you can't do it. It is obviously at some step illegal to pass them on to gun runners and to drug cartels, but being able to prove those cases was proving to be very, very difficult. Now, the problem is that we don't know how they expected to be able to prosecute on the Mexico side. And the other problem is that there's this tendency within the whole Plan Mexico and the way that the United States is approaching the drug war to kind of want to blame Mexico for everything, for what's really transnational crime. And so, again, what we're seeing here is they're skipping over the part of the smuggling, the part of the cartel operations that's happening in the United States, trying to make these busts, which it looks like they were unable to do for the most part, in Mexico, and reinforcing, in some sense, this image like the whole problem is in Mexico.
You're listening to Worldview on WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonnell, speaking with Laura Carlson. She's director of the Americas Program for the Center for International Policy in Mexico City, and we're talking about Operation Fast and Furious. It was run by the U.S. Justice Department's Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, where more than 2,500 weapons made it to Mexican crime organizations under the nose of the U.S., and one border agent of the U.S. was killed by one of these weapons. What is the larger implication of what this says about how we're prosecuting the drug war?
I think the major point here is that this whole drug war model of using an enforcement and interdiction model in order to confront what has essentially been treated before as a public safety and health problem is leading to an explosion in corruption on both sides of the border and obviously an explosion of violence in Mexico as well. And then what we have is what's called shared responsibility, where the United States says we have our responsibility because we're the major market for illegal drugs in the world and certainly for the drugs that are coming through Mexico and being produced in Mexico, and so we'll help Mexico with its problem. When in fact the most lucrative part of the drug war and of transnational crime is taking place right here in the United States. So instead of looking at changing the way that we deal with consumption of illicit substances in the United States and looking at why so much corruption can exist here within our own borders, they're going to Mexico, they're carrying out these operations that are clearly not working under this failed model. The violence has increased, the power of the drug cartels, and this is something that Obama said recently that's also scandalized Mexico, that in fact the power of the drug cartels has grown in recent years rather than diminished after a lot of investment and a lot of violence and bloodshed has gone into this model. And the other thing that's clear and that enrages Mexicans is the disdain that the United States has for its supposed partner in this drug war, the fact that everyone within ATF was instructed not to tell the Mexican government anything about this program and to keep it strictly hush-hush. And the reason that they were given, according to the whistleblowers, is that they didn't trust the Mexican government.
But they end up looking as corrupt as the Mexican government if they're allowing crimes to go unpunished. I mean, what is the definition of corruption?
And I think by any logical account, even without knowing all the facts, because we never know all the facts about a clandestine industry like this, the United States has to be as corrupt. You can't have drugs going over a binational border and being distributed to every city and town in the United States without there being some corruption existing in the United States. And it's also difficult to explain a fiasco like this Fast and Furious program without there being an element of corruption, because the rationale just doesn't hold water.
What do you think the upshot of this whole investigation by Congress is going to be? They're going to keep asking questions, and eventually somebody's going to have to answer them.
I certainly hope so, because somebody should answer them, and it should go as high up as it has to go, no matter who falls, because this is serious. This cannot be done. You can't do this to a neighboring country, and the resulting violence of passing those guns, allowing them to walk, as they call it, over the border, was notable even to the ATF agents in Mexico City. I'm afraid, on the other hand, that there'll be an investigation, that there'll be some lower-level people that are held responsible for making supposedly bad decisions, that the broader context of how this happened will be ignored, and like so many things that have to do with the failure of the drug war, we'll see it swept under the carpet, and the interests that are driving this war and expanding it in Mexico will prevail, and we'll have more funding from the United States side, more funding for the Mexican side, and an increasing number of deaths within Mexico.
You're listening to Worldview on WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonald, speaking with Laura Carlson, Director of the Americas Program at the Center for International Policy in Mexico City. Well, the Washington budget is going through its process, and how does funding for this drug war as it is stand? Are we doing the same thing again?
We are indeed, and there's been no critical evaluation in the meantime, despite all this evidence in Mexico that it's failing and that it's having a counterproductive impact on the country in many aspects, most notably the violence, with 35,000 people dead in drug-related homicides since the drug war was launched at the end of 2006, but also in other areas, including the erosion of governability and disappearances and displacements and areas that have come virtually lawless, like Ciudad Juarez. But in this budget, we have the Merida Initiative pop up again. It has a budget of close to $300 million. There is quite a bit less for the military than there has been in the past.
The Obama administration makes the argument that we're changing the initiative and we're making it less about guns and more about social incentives.
That's true. Some people even call it the Beyond Merida Initiative. However, we've done a study of it, and what you see is that in the direct foreign military funding, there is quite a bit less money. There's $8 million compared to hundreds of million in the past. But most of the money is still concentrated in the anti-narcotics work. A lot of that is going to the police forces, who on the ground act very similar to the armed forces in Mexico. There's a high degree of corruption there. There have been civilian deaths also related to the actions of the federal police. And you still have it within this umbrella of the drug war model that's putting the focus on interdiction and enforcement on the supply side rather than saying, what can we do about demand that will strangle the resources to these drug cartels? Because direct confrontation is not working. Really, the only way to diminish their power within society and to diminish the violence is to strangle off their resources. And you do that by going after demand. And one of the quickest ways to go after demand is to legalize, because it eliminates an illicit market, particularly if we start by talking about marijuana.
I think one of the things that a lot of people in the United States have a hard time understanding is how much this situation has changed Mexico and what life is like for cities and towns. Can you tell us what kind of changes have occurred in Mexico that you can see on the ground?
In many places, because it's not a uniform process, it's focalized, especially in border towns and in some areas like Cuernavaca, which is quite near Mexico City where I am, but not in Mexico City, in Michoacán, and in places especially where there's turf wars between cartels. Life has changed drastically. And it's not just Mexico. I'm on a tour right now to speak against the drug war, and I began it at the University of Texas Pan American campus. And I didn't know much about this campus, but it's in McAllen, Texas, right across the border from Reynosa, Mexico. And they take a lot of international students, students that aren't even living in the United States but actually come from Mexico. So we got ready for this event, and the auditorium began to fill up, and there were over 300 people there. And I start to talk to these students, and almost every one of them had a story about how their life has been affected. The family that still lives in Tamaulipas, the state across the border there, or themselves who still live there. One person began to talk about how her family was from a place called Ciudad Mier, and that entire town has become a ghost town, because the conflict became so intense despite the presence of the army. And that's another question that we can't answer, why the army is not able to defend people in these situations. And people were threatened to such a degree that they all were forced to move out. She said, we can't even go back to our homes to leave flowers on the graves of our grandparents. Another person said that her father runs public transportation. He owns a bus in the Mexican border town, and that he routinely goes into the office and pays what he owes to run the bus service, and there's a little desk set up alongside, and that's what he pays as a quota to the drug cartels. So this is the degree to which it's affecting people's lives in Mexico and even along the border region, not in the form of spillover violence, because that's a myth in terms of homicide and actual violence. It's a myth that's been created to justify the border militarization that we've seen, but in the form of how it affects people's lives, because so many families are binational on the border, it's a reality that's been absolutely incredible and very tragic to watch over the last couple of years.
Even if we want to get things back to normal, is that easy to do now?
No, in a lot of senses, the demons have been let out of the box, because the way people generally talk about the situation before this violence started is that the government had agreements with drug cartels so that they sort of divvied up many of the major trafficking routes, production areas, and markets within Mexico, and they weren't warring with each other. When the drug wars launched, without a lot of forethought, for what it appears, they get into a situation where if they weaken a certain cartel, then another cartel comes up and tries to take over that turf. Or there are turf wars that are very, very bloody, and that's why you have a situation like Tamaulipas or like Ciudad Juarez. At this point, even if people wanted to go back to that kind of agreement making with government, which you can't really defend ethically, but many people are a bit nostalgic for it because at least it didn't mean that civilians were getting shot in the streets. It would probably be impossible because these drug cartels have fragmented, and so they are fighting each other for turf, and you can't put that back in the box, so to speak. The only real hope then is this kind of longer-term, admittedly, strategy, although the drug war is certainly looking long-term these days, to cut off the resources of the drug cartels. And that's where you see the United States needed to take a major role in reducing demand, in looking at the possibility of legalization, and also looking at what's going on with this money. The financial structures to launder this money, to move this money back and forth, to reinvest this money, most of them exist within mainstream financial institutions, the big banks, Western Union, and money wiring services. And there's been a very minor effort, to say the least, to really investigate this part of it. And I think it has to do with the power of these institutions who rely on a lot of this money. We're talking about up to $30 billion a year in drug money that goes to Mexico, and they don't want to lose that liquidity. But unless we get serious about going after that aspect of it, which is less violent, theoretically, we can never really diminish the power of these drug cartels.
Laura Carlson is director of the Americas Program at the Center for International Policy in Mexico City. Thanks a lot for joining us again. Nice to see you in Chicago.
Thank you, Jerome.
You can read more from Laura Carlson and her crew at the Americas Program at cipamericas.org.